Right, folks, today we have a special off bi-weekly meeting session of the Architecture Workgroup to have a presentation from the BESU folks on the overview of the BESU architecture. Dano, Lucas, please take it from here.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. Dano, you want to start? You've got the slides ready, or you want me to share? Oh, okay.
Let me finish sharing.
And as you bring it up, just a quick reminder for those of you who are not familiar with the Linux Foundation antitrust policy, please look that up on the website.
All right, I should have put that on here as the Surgeon General's warning. Antitrust policy and code of conduct. Learn them, live them.
All right.
And why can't I navigate? There we go. So our agenda for this meeting, we're going to split it up basically into two parts. I'm going to handle the first part where I'm going to talk about mostly the theory and basics and some BESU-specific features and how BESU deals with these. I can talk about networking, contract execution, and then how chain reorgs work. Then I'm going to hand it off to Lucas. And a lot of what I'm going to be teaching in the basics is going to set the foundation for what's special about what we do with private transactions and privacy groups and some of the future work that's coming ahead. So to jump in, this is an incomplete introduction to Hyperledger, BESU, and Ethereum. I don't cover everything. I cover what is needed to provide what is unique and what is special. The first thing when talking about Ethereum is we probably need to start talking about the networking layer. One of the things that I think distinguishes BESU from some of the other Hyperledger DLTs is that everything initially is on an open peer-to-peer gossip-based network. And in the default mode, in the permissionless mode that you would see on like the Ethereum mainnet, all peers are equal. All peers can do everything. All peers can receive all messages. All peers can send all messages, and they can do all tasks. Just a second, let me turn off my notifications so I don't get any more bings. There we go. So things that a node might do is they might produce blocks that are to be put on the blockchain through proof of work mining. They might have connections to people who are validating on the edge. They might perform network discovery, and they might share the transactions that have come around. They might do all these various tasks. And in the mainnet, I'm sorry, does someone need to mute? Yeah, there we go. So in Ethereum mainnet, all of the tasks, any node can do any of them, and anything can come from any source. And the way they do that is they just gossip the messages. They don't care where the source came from. All that matters is the correctness of the message. If it's a transaction, they care that the signature is correct and validated. If a block goes around, they care that the transactions are all valid with it, and they all come to the same consensus of the value, and that the proof of work is correct. It doesn't matter who told them what this was. If the data checks out, they believe it and they pass it on when asked about it to others, and they share it with all the other people gossiping in the network. As far as proof of authority networks, like Qlik and IBFT, that opens up some opportunities to do different things. To begin with, not every node can then produce a block, can put a block on the blockchain. Only nodes that have specific keys can produce it in the various ways that they participate. Qlik and IBFT have two slightly different approaches, but only a core set of block producing nodes or validators can produce these. We don't put restrictions on edge validation as part of the consensus protocol or on network discovery. Those still behave the same. Everyone can connect to everyone. Any message can come from anywhere. We'll believe anything as long as the data checks out and the signatures matter. So one thing that we do have, in addition to above and beyond these consensus protocols, is we have in BESU added some private node permissioning. As a bit of background, every Ethereum node is associated with a private key. You see that in the eNode if you look in the logs, and it's challenged and validated during the handshake of the peer-to-peer communications. So when you're talking with a node, you know that node is associated with a public key that has a private key to prove it. So based on this information, BESU has node and account-based permissioning. I'll talk about accounts in a later slide, but also with nodes. We can limit which nodes can connect to each other on the chain per the permissioning with Besu, and we can limit which accounts can post transactions. There's two ways this can be done. There is a configurable per node method where you just have a configuration file and where you say, here's the accounts that can post transactions, and here's the nodes that can connect to me. And with a flat file that you can put on anything, it's just a boring basic whitelist, which for a lot of applications, it's what's needed. If you just need to enforce that your consortium consists of only these 10 nodes, 5 are producing, 5 are sharing at the edge, then you're fine. That's all that you need to do to set up. But we also provide the option to configure these permissions as to which accounts, which transactions can be posted, and which nodes can connect via smart contracts. And the rules you can put in these smart contracts are literally whatever you want. You can have basic whitelists that are maintained on the blockchain of who can connect and who can't. You can do more advanced things, such as in the accounts, you can accept any transaction so long as it's under $20. That's the type of a smart contract thing you can do. You could go crazier. You could have banker's hours. You could look at the time on the blockchain and say, well, I only accept transactions and connections between 8 and 4, Mondays to Fridays, excluding certain holidays. You can do even more convoluted approvals because it's a smart contract. These smart contracts live on the blockchain, and each node will point to that contract to verify the logic to go with it. So you're not stuck with the permissionless, everyone can connect and gossip everywhere and share everything. You can build your nodes to reflect the particular taxonomy that you may be required, and you can enforce transaction rules that your particular application may require. For example, you have a blockchain for election donations, and depending upon the nation, they all have different rules. In America, if it's under $20, you don't care who donates it, as long as it's a real person. If it's above, there's all sorts of strict rules that go in. In the UK, they have even different rules about donations, about who can and who can't. You encode those in a smart contract. So any questions about networking and permissioning before I go to the next step? Put them in the chat, I guess, if you have them. I'll try and keep an eye out. The next set of topics is to talk about block production and how blocks are produced. So here is kind of a implementation schematic on the right of how it looks like inside of a Besu. You have the synchronizer, You have the synchronizer, which downloads blocks from other nodes, and then a block propagation manager that keeps tracks of which nodes that it's seen and which nodes to send out. There's another part of the transaction pool. In addition to gossiping blocks, we gossip the individual transactions. And so we have a list of transactions that haven't been put into blocks. And similarly, we need to share transactions that other nodes may not have seen. And the last piece is the miner. In proof of work, it's gonna be a literal proof of work miner in Etash. And in proof of authority, it's going to be where you put your consensus protocols to say, you know, what round is it? Someone's asking for a vote, I sign the vote. It's my turn to produce, I produce the block, everyone votes on it. So that's where you put all that complex consensus logic. Now with proof of work, which is the only fully permissionless node mode we support, any node can produce a block provided they provide appropriate work to match the difficulty. And proof of authority, which is our click and IBFT consensus algorithms, nodes have the keys, and only those nodes with the keys can actually sign the blocks to meet the regulations and rules for what can go out. And IBFT has an even different peer-to-peer protocol talking about it. Now, block production is just simply the process of taking the previous block, taking some set of pending transactions, validating that they're correct on the block, and calculating the new data and sharing it out. It's not a terribly difficult process. We don't put in any fancy things about, you know, which transaction came first, which transaction came second. Right now, that is all the block producer's decision as to what comes out. What matters on the other end is that all the blocks see this block, they see the transactions, they've agreed on a set of consensus rules, they can reproduce the exact same results. And then and only then are they supposed to be sharing the block bodies around. Now, while you're waiting for it's your turn to produce a block, you store the gossip transactions in what's typically called the memory pool or the pending transactions. And as new blocks come in, you pull transactions that are seen in the block out of that pending transaction pool. So it's a process of, you know, every so often you'll produce a block, transactions come in, they go out, you check them in and out, and you share them and you gossip the transactions in the blocks. Blocks contain transactions. So where things get interesting is how the consensus algorithms deal with deciding who gets to make the next block. in proof of work in Ethereum, this is pretty common Nakamoto consensus. Whoever finds the proof of work shares it and they win. Ethereum specifies something that's not strictly enforced because it's the protocol level, called the greediest heavy observed subtree, because in a proof of work algorithm, the block, the chain can fork. So when you're looking at the various forks that you're gonna pick, that's an algorithm to say which one you should choose and go forward with. You should pick the one that has the most proof of work in the subtree you're working on and build off of that. Eventually, someone will win, the other Omers will lose and die out. Click is a little bit different. Click still allows for forking, but instead of having to do proof of work, what matters is how recently a validator has produced a block. And there's a limited set of validators, and the validators can vote each other in and out. So it's a small consortium of block producers that can vote each other in and out and produce these blocks. Now, when you produce a block, the heaviest weight is given to the validator that is quote-unquote intern. And that is the validator that hasn't produced a block since all of the other validators have produced a block. So if everyone produces a block, then it's your turn. And you get more difficulty weight on that. However, sometimes validators go offline, there's net splits, they produce a bad block. If you have had at least half of the other validators produce a block before you, if you notice that a block is scheduled to occur and hasn't happened, you could propose a block yourself that has lesser weight than the intern block. So eventually the network will come to consensus with a missing validator, as long as at least half of the validators are producing blocks. They'll be able to produce these and the chain shouldn't fork too much. And again, the same ghost fork selection rule should apply here. When blocks with heavier, with intern block production will receive more use from the other peers. Finally, we have a BFT algorithm, IBF2. The feature here is there's finality, there's no forking, only one goes out. I am not the consensus expert on that. That particular consensus expert, our whole team is in Australia and asleep right now. So there's a bit of hand waving, but it's BFT. I don't know what makes it Istanbul different from Practical or the other forms of BFT. One thing is I think that they don't require a complete connection between all of the validators. It can work in a partially connected network between the validators, and it can still share with the gossiping approach. It doesn't require total connection amongst all the peers to see all the signatures. So any questions about consensus and block production? Easy crowd. So the next thing to talk about in the basics of Ethereum is transaction execution. So the transaction data is all stored in accounts, and accounts in Ethereum are basically hashes of the public ECDSA keys of a public private key pair. So we only keep the first 20 bytes out of a particular hash of a particular algorithm, and that forms the address of your account. So that's how we maintain a pseudonymity, is we only address it by a hash driven by the key that you have. Now, what we store in the account state is what the current value balance is. If there is a smart contract associated with your account, we store that. Right now, we only support Ethereum Virtual Machine. That is the standard across all Ethereum implementations right now. There has been talk of getting Wasm working, but none of them have actually shipped in a fully functioning Ethereum client yet. Parity has kind of a form of it, but it's not seen on any Ethereum Foundation testnet yet. It might show up in Ethereum 2.0, but that's to be seen. And the last thing that they store in the account is the particular persistent state, kind of a memory that is associated just with that account. Now, each transaction can execute EVM code when you post a transaction. The transaction comes from an account. An account signs it to prove that it's valid. It may or may not have a transaction and an EVM script in it. It might just be moving value around. Value is what we use for, you know, ethers, is the general code value, is just what we call the value of the ether that is kept separate from the account balance. A transaction might actually deploy a contract to a different account. It's called an account creation transaction. So create a new account that has smart contract code. Or the transaction might simply call code stored in another account, set up a set of parameters, and pass those into the call. So those are what the EVM transactions could contain, one of those three formulas. Now, when executing an EVM transaction in the EVM code, one thing you need to pay attention to is gas. Gas is the principal anti-abuse mechanism in Ethereum. Every operation code, every op code has a certain gas value that goes with it. Some are fixed, some are variable based on things like how much memory you expanded. And the gas in the end is charged to Ether on public chains. The value that is associated with the change, you multiply the gas by some value of gigaway that turns into like some fractional part of Ether that is charged to the value. If you don't have that much Ether, then your transaction is not executed. And so that's how the to have transactions run, you need to have Ether to run those transactions. In a private network, this charge can be set to zero. So the gas simply exists to make sure that the virtual machine does not go out of control in an infinite loop and terminates in a terminal problem. It kind of solves the halting problem. Eventually, you're going to run out of gas and you will halt if you spend too much gas. Otherwise, we couldn't guarantee that any of these transactions would ever halt. As far as the transaction storage, there's three levels of storage during the execution. The stack is used principally by the opcodes to use their arguments. For the opcodes, you can do regular stack-based logic to store things around. That's not always the easiest place to store useful memory. So there is a transient per execution batch of memory that you can generate that you can store your stuff on the side, kind of treated like registers or regular old memory. This disappears for each transaction. And finally, there is the persistent state. This is the sload and the sstore function. This data is persistent across all transactions. And it's typically where you're storing things like who has which account balance and which tokens, who's authorized to do this transaction. That's your longer term persistent data would be stored in this persistent state. I left a bullet point there I should have deleted. Now the state root for each transaction is all this data about what all the account state is and what all each account's individual state is reduced up into a single hash through a Merkle tree-like process. The particular format that Ethereum uses is a Patricia tree. And basically the main difference is a Patricia tree has 16 children per node, whereas a Merkle tree typically will just have 2 children per node. And from this tree, we can reduce all of the values, and everything in that tree is stored by the address of what the persistent memory is, or by the account number of what the account of that you're dealing with is in the account tree. And so all this is reduced up to a single hash code. And so that 256-bit hash is what is put into the account header to show what the current state of the account tree is. And by extension, the account trees has a hash of the persistent state of the accounts in their individual spaces. So that all is pushed up into a couple of them of hashes that are stored in the block header. So like I said, go ahead.
Good question. So when state root, is this the state root post transaction, and how does this deal with consensus and blocks and so forth? That is
right. So this is the state root post transaction. You would use the state root of the previous transaction, and you would need to keep your state from your previously calculated. I think that's the next slide. Yeah. So you would need to keep your state from the previously calculated transactions in memory. So as you would write data to it and change it, you would push your writes back up along the tree to recalculate a new root. So this root is just what the state was at the end of it, built off of what the previous one was.
I see. So for each node, as it's building a new block, it keeps updating the transaction with the live transactions in the block being built included?
That's one way to do it. ASU actually keeps a list of what's changed during the whole block. And then at the end of the block, it does the bubble up process where it updates the Patricia tree nodes only on an as-needed basis. That's an optimization, because if one particular account is being hammered heavily, you would do the same bubble up every time to have a net change of one from this at the beginning of the block to this at the end of the block. So if we just do that value once, rather than doing all, if there were 16 transactions, rather than bubbling it up 16 times, we just take the state at the beginning and the state at the end, and we bubble that up, and all we care about is the end state at the end of the block. We don't store per transaction roots.
Okay, got it. And the state root itself is not included in the There's no recursion there, I guess. Somehow you're
right.
Okay.
Right. The state root itself is very much the root. Okay. It would be very entertaining to see if someone could produce a Merkle tree loop on that. I think, is that on the storage is the next? So I'll go ahead and talk about this a bit in the storage, but it'd be very entertaining if someone were to make a Merkle tree loop, because rather than storing the entire tree in like one database entry, we take each node of the tree and it's 16 roots and we store that. So when you need to do a read, you look at the root, you see what the child value is, and then you look what that child value is until eventually you hit a value node in the Patricia tree and then you return your value. So it has a recursive lookup. So if someone were able to get a hash collision on that, you know, that would be very entertaining. But because we use 256-bit hashes, that would be like, you know, that would be something for the science journal if someone could reliably produce that. It would be an amazing feat that would destroy a lot of things. So as far as the account storage, the global account storage just contains the account data. It's a Patricia tree where the nodes are just the account values, the hashed up values. Now in each of the accounts, there's a hash of their own local storage tree that again goes down. And in Besu, each state node is just stored in a key value store. We rely on the functionally zero collision property of the hash algorithm we're using with 256 bits, that it's gonna be impossible to get a collision, functionally impossible, not technically impossible. And we just take those nodes and we put them in the key value store where the node is the key and the value is the Patricia tree entry or the particular account entry. And the same thing, we put in the same storage for the account state. And one thing is we've introduced pruning in this most recent thing, in one of our most recent releases. Whenever a value would go into the key value storage, we wouldn't remove it. We would keep it there forever, which for small change seems to work. You could just shut down your node and rebuild it if you need to clear up storage. We've introduced actual pruning where we'll look at the most recent state and we'll mark all of the nodes that make up that state for the mark phase. And then we'll sweep through, we'll iterate all of the node keys. And if it's not in that state needed to keep the current state, we'll delete it. So it's kind of like we run a garbage collection sweep on it every so often as an option. So in the end, only the root hash goes into the account storage itself, into the account entry. And for the block, only the root of the storage tree goes into the block header. And similarly, we do a different hash to hash up which transactions go in the block header and a bunch of other bookkeeping data about all the things that go in. As far as the gossip protocol goes, when you have that hash, you can say, give me the accounts that match this hash for this block. And by gossip, we'll share all that data around. So we share just the headers. You can ask for the block bodies. You can ask for the transactions. You can ask for all the pieces that go in there. But what goes into the hash is just what shows up in the block header. And that's what determines the proof of work and the consensus from that. Now, again, each node, before they accept a block header, they should validate that everything checks out, because all the EVM executions are supposed to be 100% deterministic. With the same input, you should always get the same output, which is what makes all this work. Now, one final interaction with the consensus algorithms and the storage is how chain reorgs work for a non-finalized consensus protocol. Now, here I'm only talking about CLIC and ETASH. I'm not talking about IBFT because IBFT features finality and they don't really do forks. So the diagram on the right is what a typical fork and reorg type solution might look like. You see block one, you read it. You see block two, you read it. You see what becomes block three and you read it, and that's the state you're working off of. But at the same time, some other miner or some other node produced a different block three that you didn't accept because maybe it has the same difficulty or you just plain old didn't see it. So what happens is you'll eventually get a broadcast for block four. And block four will be pointing to a different block three than the block three that you're working on. And you see that dashed line arrow. One of the things that Ethereum tracks is it tracks OMRs. They used to be called uncles, but OMR is the gender neutral term for relative of first degree, like aunts and uncles. So these OMRs are tracked in the header. So you'll get a block four, and it'll point to block three, and I'll be listing, it will also be listing your block three as an OMR. So that's a clue to you that a reorganization is happening. Now, the odds are that this block four will have greater weight than your block three, so you would need a reorg. So because we store all of our previous block data before, you don't really need a rewind back to block two. You just need to import block three with all of its hash data, referencing block two, import block four, and use block four as your primary block. Because we store all of the previous blocks on states in our state database, or at least enough back to allow us to reorg. And I should point out that when we do pruning like a certain number of blocks behind the current chain head. So if you do see a reorganization after we do a pruning run, you'll be able to go back as far as needed to do a reorganization. And I don't think Ethereum's seen very many deep reorganizations. Most of them go back, you know, maybe 10 blocks is like a really deep one. Bitcoin's like two or three blocks and people start panicking. But, you know, in theory, on some of the test nets, there could be changes up to 300 deep if people get some serious net splits going on. Now, to incentivize block producers to record these OMRs and find these OMRs and reference these in the block headers, we give a small block reward for finding the OMRs. And the miners who mine these blocks still get a lesser reward for having mined the block. So that is a hedge against the selfish miner problem. You actually get rewarded for sharing your mining data as soon as possible, even if you don't wind up in the production block. Now, as I said, basic reorgs are relatively simple because we store it all in a key value store and we have within the horizon all the blocks we would need to reorganize. Some other clients do a different approach where they only keep the literal chain head as their database. For those, the way that they deal with reorganizations is they'll keep a rollback log. So from 3' to 2 and from 2 to 1, they'll keep a list of data. What data do I need to change to roll this back? When they determine that a reorg is going to happen, they'll roll back to the common node, which in this case will be 2. So they'd roll back 3' to 2. And they would replay 3 and 4 on top of 2 to get back to 4. There's pluses and minuses to that approach. There's, you know, it's basically you got to pick what your problem are. The problem with BASU is it tends to use a bit more storage data to store its data. But the problem with the rollback and play forward is that reorgs can take a long time. It can impact your block production. So it depends on what your use cases are and what you're looking for, whether you would do a keep all recent or data model or a rollback model. And one thing that's worth noting with the Patricia tree layout, there's not as much different data stored between the different blocks as you would look. There's a lot of shared data between 1, 2, 3, and 4. So the differences that are stored in the blocks are mostly the rollups and the actual changes. All of the branches that didn't change in the Patricia tree will be shared between 1, 2, 3, 3', and 4. So you get some space savings. It's not like we're keeping 5 different copies in the database. We're keeping closer to something to 1.01% for these 5 blocks of the changes that might be there. There's a lot of duplication that goes on in there. Any questions about Ethereum basics before I hand it off to Lucas? All right. Feel free to post in chat if you do have questions. I'll hand off to Lucas now.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel. So would you mind keeping the slides up and then you just skip them for me? Is that okay?
Just tell me when to advance.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. So hi, everyone. We're going to now go one step further into BESU and start to understand how private transactions happen inside BESU. Before talking about how we implemented private transactions, I think it's important to mention the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance, the EEA. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with the EEA, but the EEA is a group of companies that are working together on creating a standard for enterprise Ethereum clients. And that might be the first time that you guys heard about this concept of enterprise Ethereum client and you know what it means. And one of the reasons for that is because there's no one easy answer. Part of the work that EEA is doing is actually come up with the answer of what is a enterprise Ethereum client and what are the enterprise features that people want to see in an enterprise Ethereum client. So there's a technical specification working group that is working towards defining a client implementation and specification. And again, this specification is going to define what an enterprise Ethereum client looks like, what are the enterprise features, how they work, And the main goal with this work is to make sure that different enterprise Ethereum clients can interoperate with each other. So if we look at public Ethereum, you know, it doesn't matter if you're using Besu or Geth or Parity, because they all implemented the same public Ethereum protocol, you know, you can pretty much start your chain with one node and then swap to the second one with zero or maybe close to zero effort. and we want to achieve the same thing into, you know, with enterprise features. So, you know, if you're using private transactions, how can you, you know, interop between different nodes and different implementations? So as you imagine, private transactions is a big piece of the EA specification. In this presentation, I won't get into every single detail of the spec. But you know, if you guys are interested, I recommend you guys to go and read the spec. I think we've got a link to the spec in the reference in the final slide. So I want to focus in two concepts here. One is the concept of participants, and the second one is the concept of private transaction types. So the difference between a private transaction to a, you know, a regular Ethereum public transaction, it's basically a list of participants. So in Ethereum, when you're sending a transaction, every single node is going to have access to that transaction eventually, right? The transaction is going to be mined, included in a block. And when someone processes that block, everyone can see the transaction. The basic difference for a private transaction is that when you send it, you want to be able to specify a list of participants or a list of nodes that should have access to that transaction. So we are talking about introducing this concept of a private state where the public transactions won't have the private transactions won't affect the public state anymore. They will just affect you, your private state, and they are going to be shared among the participants. The second thing that is important to understand private transactions is the difference between the restricted and unrestricted transaction types. And more important, it's just because in Besu at the moment, we only have restricted private transactions implemented. The specification for the unrestricted are still a bit loose. But the main difference is that a restricted in a restricted private transaction, the client needs to ensure that the transaction data is only sent to the participants. So if I'm sending a transaction, if I'm creating a private transaction between Deno and I, only my node and Deno's node is going to have access to the actual transaction data. Meanwhile, in the unrestricted private transactions, we don't have this restriction. That's why it's unrestricted. Basically, the private transaction data can be distributed to every node in the network. But that doesn't mean that all nodes actually have access to the transaction data or know what the transaction data is doing. So in theory you wouldn't need like a side channel to propagate your private transactions. You would do that through, you know, the regular channels that you already have. It's a bit tricky to explain how this can be implemented, and that's one of the reasons that the specification is a bit loose. But that's when you get into like those ZK snarks kind of scenarios where you can actually share a proof that something happened without actually telling what was done, those kind of thing. Again, I'm not the expert, so I won't get into the detail of how this could be implemented, especially because Besu doesn't have unrestricted implemented. Next slide, please, Dan.
Actually, maybe...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I forgot to ask if anyone has a question.
Yeah. So perhaps it's a high-level question. Not sure it's specific to this slide. But let's say we have a Besu network with IBFT. Is mm-hmm. that still talking to the Ethereum mainnet?
Okay, so when we're talking about a Besu network using IBFT, usually you'll be looking at a private or permission network. Uh-huh. So every node in the network needs to use the same consensus algorithm. So mainnet at the moment is using proof of work.
So you can have a Besu network where it's all private nodes and just running IBFT between them, and there's no, it's a completely private network. And then this Correct. Private transaction is the ability to then have a transaction which is private only to a subset of the nodes that are participating in the IBFT network. Is that correct?
Almost, yeah. So The concept of private transactions can also be applied to a public Ethereum network.
Okay.
So the idea is that you are able to send a transaction to a subset of the nodes in the network.
Got it.
Right.
Whether that's an IBFT network or whether you're running Besu with the mainnet, either way, exactly. You can use private transactions.
Exactly. So, one of my final slides, I'm going to talk about how we actually want to enable mainnet to use private transactions. But you're right.
Yeah, right now restricted transactions are not on mainnet.
Yeah.
Got it.
Cool. Next slide, please. Okay, let's talk a little bit about how private transactions are implemented in Besu. So as I've mentioned, Besu implemented the restricted type of private transactions at the moment. And before I show you guys like a diagram of how exactly things happen, I just think it's important to highlight three components in the architecture that play a key role on private transaction processing. So the first one is Orion. And Orion can be called as a private transaction manager if you want to use EEA terminology. It will take care of the private transaction distribution to the participants of a private transaction. So again, because you need to specify who is party to that transaction when you send, Orion is going to take the transaction and the list of the participants and make sure that the transaction reaches each one of the participant nodes. It takes care of everything, encrypting, making sure that if the information is leaked, at least it's going to be encrypted. It's going to take care of delivery and everything. So this is one key. It's the side channel that we use to propagate private transactions. The second important piece here is the privacy pre-compiled smart contract. And I don't know if everyone is familiar with the concept of a pre-compiled contract, but basically, if you remember, Daniel was saying how we can deploy contracts and that's going to be an account with EVM bytecode stored. A pre-compiled, it works as a regular smart contract in a way, but it doesn't execute EVM bytecode. So it still has an address, so you can send a transaction to that pre-compiled. But when we are processing that transaction, we know that this is a pre-compiled, and then we're going to execute native code. So in Besu's case, we're going to execute Java code. And we use the precompiler to implement private transaction processing logic in the client. The second component that is important for private transaction processing is the private market transaction. This is not actually a component. It's more one thing that happens during the private transaction creation, but I thought it was important to mention it. So when we are talking about about transactions in Ethereum, like regular transactions, and how they affect the state, the most important thing is the order that the transactions are executed, right? Because your final state is going to be generated by the sequence of operations or the sequence of transactions applied to it. That's why in Ethereum, we have the specific sequence of blocks, and in each block has a sequence of transactions. The order is important to define your state. And you get to your final state by the executing the transactions one by one. The same thing stands for private transactions in the private state. We need to make sure that every participant of a private transaction is going to execute those private transactions in the same order, so they're going to yield the same private state. If they decide to do things in a different order, it's going to be a mess. So the way that we did this was using a privacy market transaction. So I'll just use PMT for, make it easier. So a PMT is a public transaction. Excuse me. It's a public transaction that contains a link to a private transaction. And when the participants see that private market transactions, the PMT, that they know that they should follow the link and execute the private transaction that is associated to that PMT. It sounds a bit fancy, but basically the PMT has a key that can be used to retrieve the transaction from Orion later on when it's time to process it. It's almost like we are piggybacking on the public chain ordering to ensure that the private transactions are going to be executed in a specific order. Again, one thing that is important is that the PMT doesn't really carry any information about the private transaction. So all the private transaction information is stored in Orion. The PMT only has a key that can be used to retrieve that that the original private transaction. And basically what happens is that if your node is a participant of the net of the private transaction, when you ask for the private transaction using that key, you get back the transaction. If your node is not a participant, when you ask for that transaction using the key, you don't get anything. I'll just pause for a moment because before I move to the next slide, I don't wanna know if anyone has any questions. I can see that there are some messages in the chat. I'm not sure if they are questions or... Any questions before we move on?
Yeah, I just asked if there are any documentation references for these things that you would recommend.
Yes, we do. The final slide has a lot of references to like the best of documentations on how things are implemented, and you can see. So we go a bit more in detail of how this happens.
So should we think of the Orion nodes as forming like a sub-network or an overlay of sorts, or how do we picture? And how is it different when you're using IBFT in a private network versus using the public network?
Okay, so to answer your first questions, yes, you can imagine Orion as a secondary network that's used to distribute the private transactions. This is correct. And how? Oh, sorry, your second question. How it is different from using IBFT in a private network?
Yeah.
Okay, so. The concept of when usually when we talk about private networks, we are talking about a network that we have completely control of the nodes and the participants of that network, right?
Right.
When we talk about private transactions, again, this is more related to within this network with nodes, a subset of nodes that are going to have access to that private transaction. So imagine that you might have a private network with three nodes. Mm-hmm. But you want to send a transaction only between nodes A and B, mm-hmm. right? So this is when you would use a private transaction in a private network.
Right.
You know, I don't know if I managed to make it clear, right? And yeah. The same thing, in theory, the same thing could apply for like a mainnet public network, right? So you have mainnet, a public network, mm-hmm. and you want to send a transaction only between two or three nodes.
Yeah.
In theory, you could achieve the same thing. As long as you, so it's a subset of your network that is going to have access to that private transaction.
Correct. Right. So the Orion node, is that an external component? Let's say I have a private network of five nodes, A through E. And so is there an Orion node running on all five of these nodes? And if I want a network, a transaction that's private only to A and B, mm-hmm. how am I using the Orion nodes to do that?
So I'll start saying that the recommended deployment diagram would be one Orion node per best node.
Okay.
Just because then you ensure that you've got like your data isolated and separate from other nodes or something like that. There is a use case where we call it like multi-tenant Orion or something like on those lines where people might be able to share one Orion instance between more than one BESU node. So if you're thinking about like the use case where you have a consortium network and I own like three nodes in that network, maybe I don't care if like my three nodes have access to any private transactions that are sent to any one of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, got it.
And then from the point of like a deployment diagram to like save money on, you know, saving money running servers or something, I might decide to share a Orion instance, but it's easier to imagine each Orion, each BESU node paired with one Orion node. You know, that's kind of the recommended use case, I would say.
Okay. So then how do I keep A's and B's information private? If there's an Orion node running on CDE, do they see the private transaction?
No, so the private transaction, so Orion's going to build this overlay network of nodes, right?
Yeah.
And when we send a private transaction, I'm going to specify the participants. And basically, what the participant identification is a public key that is linked to its Orion node, right? So yeah. I didn't get into the detail of exactly how this works with Orion, but Orion pretty much keeps a list of keys and URLs. So it knows who owns the specific keys.
Okay.
So when you send a transaction between A and B, Orion knows that, okay, the only thing I need to do is propagate this transaction to B if you're sending it from A, you know? So it won't send the transaction to the other Orion nodes, only to the specific nodes that are supposed to receive that transaction.
And got it. Okay.
Got it. And this is also encrypted. So if by any chance this gets like leaked or, you know, it ends up reaching the wrong node, the information is encrypted. So hopefully the other node, even if it receives the payload, the node won't be able to read it. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
So I had another question. Sorry to keep pestering you. Provide some intuition for how you stop double spends across different private transactions with non-intersecting private groups?
Okay, I think, is it okay if I save this one for later? Because we're going to talk a bit more about the private state and how
absolutely.
Okay, cool. So if you don't mind saving this one for later, please, if I forget to get to it, just let me know. And we're going to get to this one. Okay. Is that cool?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So, because later on, I'm going to talk a bit more about the private state and how it was implemented, and it might help to answer this one. Okay, so let's. This is an overview of how a private transaction is created and processed in Orion. In Besu, and in Orion. So, I think probably answering some of the questions, we kind of got into this in a bit more details, but I'll just briefly go through it. So everything starts with the user calling a JSON RPC API and sending, pretty much saying, I want to send a private transaction. This is the transaction data, and this is the list of participants. And then Besu is going to handle this transaction. And the first thing that it's going to do is say, hey, Orion, I've got this private transaction, and I need to distribute that transaction to these participants. At that moment, Orion's going to take care of sending the private transactions to each one of the participants of that transaction. So when it's time to process that transaction, hopefully all the participant nodes will have the transaction already stored in their Orion, ready to be used. The second thing that happens here is number four, is that we're going to create the PMT, the privacy marker transaction. So just as a recap, in number three, when we send the transaction to Orion, Orion is going to distribute the transaction and give us back a key that can be used to identify, to find that transaction later on when you want to have access to it. We're going to create a PMT with that key or that link. I don't like using the word key here because we have so many keys in Ethereum. This is not like a cryptography key or anything. It's just like a key for a key value mapping. Just so people don't get confused, because I get confused about it sometimes. So this is like Orion has this key value mapping between with keys to payloads. So it gives you back the key, and we create the PMT with that key, send it to the transaction pool. And then from that moment onwards, this transaction, the PMT transaction, follows the same path that any other Ethereum transaction would follow. Eventually it's going to be mined and included in a block, and the block's going to be propagated, and the nodes are going to start processing the blocks.
Is that true even when we're using IBFT?
Yeah, even if they're using IBFT.
Okay.
So basically where IBFT plays a different, where the consensus algorithm changes is when we are mining and creating the blocks. So I don't, after the transaction pool.
Got it. So basically, you know, what is actually on the block, the blockchain does not have the actual transaction data.
Correct.
For private transactions.
Correct.
That is off chain in Orion. Yeah,
all that the private transaction has, sorry, all that the privacy marker transaction, the PMT has, everything that is in the chain is just like this value, this key that can be used to retrieve the private transaction.
Got it. Okay.
But it can only be used to retrieve the private transaction if you are a participant, right? Because if you are not, you wouldn't have received the transaction in the first place.
Right. Okay. Right? And I guess so that, it'd be good to understand and answer Hart's question, but we'll wait for it. You know, how do we kind of avoid conflicting transactions in with private transactions?
Next slide, please, Dana. Okay, so this is just the second leg of the process, like after the PMT is created and propagated to the network. Again, eventually that transaction is going to be mined and included in a block. And when the node is imported in the block, that's when we get into this diagram here. So every Ethereum transaction is sent with a to field. The to is the address of an account. And that account can be a contract, or it can be just like an externally owned account with a balance or something. In our case, the PMT is going to be sent to the precompile. I don't know if you guys remember one of the key components that I've mentioned, the precompile. So it works as a Ethereum contract, right? So the PMT is going to be addressed to the precompile. So when the node is processing the PMT, it knows, oh, okay, this is a PMT. So I need to call my precompile and let it handle this. When the precompile starts, processing this transaction, it knows that the data in that transaction is the key in Orion. So the process here is quite simple. So it's going to retrieve the transaction from Orion. And at this moment, again, two things can happen. If you are a participant in number three, you will be able to retrieve the transaction. And then the precompile is going to pack it into a private transaction and delegate to the private transaction processor to actually process this transaction. And that transaction is going to be processed and affect the private state. In number three, if you are not a participant, what's going to happen is that Orion is just going to reply, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have this transaction. And then the precompile will understand, okay, if Orion doesn't have this transaction, it's because I'm not a participant, and just skip the second part of processing the transaction and it's going to move on. So the interesting thing here is, from a public state point of view, because the precompile is processing a public transaction until it finds a private transaction and everything. From a public state point of view, there's no difference of processing a PMT if you are a participant or not, in terms of the public state, right? But if you are a participant, the private transaction is going to affect your private state. So, when Daniel was talking about account state storage and everything like that, we have pretty much the same thing for a private state. Does that make sense? So far?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to assume that makes sense. And this is how we can hook up private transaction processing. Again, we piggyback on the public chain just to ensure ordering and the sequence of execution for things. But the actual result of that private transaction never affects the public state, because it wouldn't make sense to affect the public state with a private transaction that only part of the network has access to. Okay. If there are no questions, I'm going to move to the next slide, please. Okay, this is when things get a bit more interesting in terms of private state. So. And hopefully after this, I will be able to answer Hart's question about double spending and things like that. So I've been talking about private state, the public and private state, right? But in reality, we haven't implemented it quite in this way in Besu. So in Besu, we have a concept of privacy groups. And each privacy group can be seen as an instance of a private state for that specific group. So basically, when you create a new privacy group, you create an empty instance of a private state. And the way that you create groups is through the participants. So if I'm sending a transaction, I think this slide has a nice image to demonstrate this. If I'm sending a transaction, I have this network with four nodes. And then I send a private transaction between nodes A, B, and C, and then another private transaction between nodes A, D, and C. So as you can see from the picture, what we are going to end up with my node A having two private states, one for each privacy group, one privacy group being ABC and the other one being ADC. And the same for my node B, it only has like the private state for the privacy group that it belongs to. And so each node is going to end up with basically one public state and one private state per privacy group that it belongs to. Okay, does it make sense? Do I make sense so far? Like the difference between one global private state but having different private states per privacy group?
Yes.
Okay. And to better understand why we took this design decision, we can probably look at what happens when we don't use privacy groups, or you know, if we what would happen if we had one single private state. So imagine a scenario where we have a single private state, and then I have this network with three nodes, and A, B, and C, let's say. And I send a transaction from A to B, and then a transaction to A from A to C. What happens at that point is that my three nodes in the network, neither of them have the same private state. So my private state in A is going to be different from the private state in B, that's going to be different from the private state in C. So I lose any property of making sure that my private states are consistent or any kind of consensus among my private states. If we look at the privacy group-based approach, I can guarantee that within a privacy group, they must have the same private state, because within that privacy group, they have to execute the same private transactions, right? Because they are for the same privacy group. And by consequence, they should have yield the same private state for that privacy group.
So is it a completely isolated state, or is there a possibility of having shared state between groups?
No, they are completely isolated. So they work as an independent state, right? So all the accounts have, so, you know, again, if you think about public state and a public Ethereum and the public state and how each account has like its own balance, has its nonce and everything. In the private state, per privacy group, each account is going to have its own nonce and balance for that privacy group. So it's completely independent. So, and hopefully this kind of gives an idea on how we can check and avoid double spending and things like that in the private world. Because, you know, each account is going to have its own nonce and everything within the private, the privacy group. So we know that, you know, when a specific account sends a transaction within that privacy group, we can avoid that account being able to, like, by mistake, sending the same transaction twice or something like that. And eventually we can also enforce and have a check that every node within that group has the same, have a consistent private state. So we can, you know, we can identify if there's a bad player within my privacy group, or even if it's not a bad player, but something happened and, you know, it failed processing one of the private transactions or something, we are able to identify that this happened and we can like recover from it. While if we only had one global private state, we wouldn't be able to do that, because the private state it's likely to be different on each node, because you are sending private transactions to different parties and different participants. Did I make it clear the difference between a global private state and using the privacy groups? Is that concept clear?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, cool. And hopefully, Hart, I don't know if that kind of helps you to see how we could avoid double spending across different, you know, private transactions.
So I have a couple of questions about that.
Okay.
First, how do you scale if you have, If you have a private state sort of for every possible set of nodes.
Participants.
Yeah. Mm. Right? Because if you have n nodes, this is going to give you like some kind of like n choose k private states, right?
Okay. So this is only true assuming that you are going to send private transactions to every single node and every single participant, right?
Yes, but I mean, it's still going to, it still has the potential to grow quite a bit, right?
It does. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that this is something that, you're right. If we have a network with like 100 participants and then I decide to send a private, to create one privacy group with each single participant, my node is going to end up with 100 private states, one for each privacy group, which is probably, 99 privacy groups, which is probably not like the best experience ever. So.
Yeah. And I'm more concerned, right? If you have to like, if you have a lot of multi-node transactions, right? So if you have, say, you know, 100 nodes and you're doing a lot of transactions with two or three different nodes, right? Mm-hmm. Then you're going to get more like 100 choose two or 100 choose three. You know, you're going to get a lot of different, you know, it's going to be polynomial in the number of nodes in the transaction, right?
Can you repeat the second part of your question? Because I think I've missed part of it.
Oh, so I was just curious, like, because let's say I have a transaction that has three participants, okay, right, including myself. If I do that with everybody, right, now I've got 100 choose two different private states to manage, right? Mm-hmm. So it like squares.
Yeah.
And sort of the more participants you add, the more difficult it gets.
True.
And the other question I had was sort of on the how you verify that the private state within the privacy group is consistent. Because what I'm kind of worried about, right, is suppose in your diagram, we don't have node C, right? So we just have A, D, and B, right?
Okay.
If A sends a private transaction to B and double spends it with D, right? Well, it has no incentive to kind of say that its private states are inconsistent. So somehow D and B need to be able to verify that their private states are consistent with A's transaction. And that's kind of what I'm curious about.
Okay, so the concept of double spending applies to like one state, right? So usually when we are thinking about like public Ethereum, you sure. have like your balance and everything. So you want to make sure that you don't spend something, you know, pretty much Ether that you don't have or something, right? So
right.
When we are talking about private states, like the example that you gave where A would send a transaction to B and then send a transaction to D, it wouldn't really make sense to think about double spending because from A, B private state point of view, only one transaction happened. And from A, D point of view, only one transaction happened, right?
Right, but if it's
so hard, that this was the question I asked earlier. They don't allow shared state across privacy groups.
Exactly. So
the AD transaction cannot touch any state that is visible to AB.
So, okay, but what if the state is like, so is there some kind of, so basically I need to move, so basically what I need to do then is I need to move the if I have something, some asset in public, right, mm-hmm. I need to move it to the private state channel before I can transfer it. Is that right? Is that what's going on here?
So an asset. So let me try to explain it with like a simple example where let's say that I have this smart contract that's going to take care of, you know, my assets and everything, right? And I want to deploy this smart contract. So if I want to be able to, like an ECR20 token contract or something, if I want to be able to actually exchange tokens between like A, B, and D, or A, B, and C, or whatever, what needs to happen is that I need to deploy this contract in the privacy group that includes all of these nodes. So I wouldn't deploy it between A and B and then between A and C. I would deploy this contract between A, B, and C, and then within that private state, for that privacy group, things would have to be consistent. That's where, you know, we would be able, because then A, B, and C will have access to like how many tokens each of them have and things like that.
Right, but then presumably if I did that, right, then C could see a transaction if A made it to B, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's kind of similar to a channel in Fabric.
Yeah, so this seems to me to be, that's a great point, and I was going to mention it as well. This just seems to be a lot like channels.
Yeah, I think what the use case that you're talking about, Hart, it's probably closely related to unrestricted private transactions, where you would have like one network with one single state, but then you would be able to send transactions among the network without somehow exposing that the details between the transfers, but still being able to verify that things happen, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So maybe I think now from your question, I think maybe that's kind of where you're getting at in terms of like, because back to the token example, if we have A, B, and C, and then I'm sending a transaction, if I want to transfer tokens between A and B, because A, B, and C are all within the same privacy group, C is going to see everything.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. I'm just trying to understand the model.
Okay. So the model, basically, I think a simplified way of putting it, everything is private within that privacy group.
And I have to like move assets to a privacy group, right?
Before yeah, I can exactly.
And in public. Okay, thank you. Yeah. No, I'm sorry for the confusion.
That's right. No, I think it was great to clarify the difference. And actually, it also highlights it one of the biggest differences between restricted and unrestricted private transactions. So I think that was great. Yeah, thanks for.
Okay, no, and, yeah. And this is good too, because this means you don't have to worry about. You don't have to worry about consistency as much.
Only within your privacy group. Cool.
I guess the only other difference is the consensus and ordering is actually happening globally, even if the transactions are private.
That's fine though, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
So yeah, the only thing is my final bullet point here that I mentioned that the privacy group is consistent, but we haven't actually implemented this yet. So in theory, because all the consensus and the ordering is handled in the public state, we can assume that if all the nodes are following the same rules, they are definitely going to end up with a consistent private state, right? Even though this is expected, we still want a mechanism where we can actually check it and recover if something happens. You know what I mean? And this is part of the future work that we're going to talk about. We are actually working on this right now. So at the moment, we assume that the private state is going to be consistent because it was generated by the sequence of private transactions executed by the node, and it's all pinned back in the public chain. So the order is there and everything is consistent. But we haven't implemented the mechanism that's going to verify it, pretty much, like the final check. And that does something if it's not consistent.
So is the goal to make the entire system BFT fault tolerant, including the private transactions and so forth?
I think the answer is probably yes. but yeah, I think yes. can we move to the next slide, Dino, if there are no more questions here? So just going to briefly mention some of the things that we are currently working on or are on in the roadmap for eventually a next version of Betsu. So one thing that I didn't mention is that the current version, so if you check out Betsu right now, the current version only works with a consensus mechanism that provide finality, like IBFT2. And the reason is, again, we talked a lot about how the order of the transactions are important, right? But when Dana was explaining a chain reorganization, basically what a reorg does is chuckling the order of the blocks and transactions. And by consequence, it changing what my expected private state would have be would have been. So if we want to be able to use if you want to be able to use private transactions with consensus algorithms that don't provide finality, we need to be able to also handle the reorgs in the private state. So basically, when a reorg in the public chain happens, you know, because I have my PMTs in the public chain, I need to be able to recover from that and then rebuild my private state based on that reorg. Does that make sense? So one of the features that we are working at the moment is actually being able to handle these reorgs also in the private world. So after the reorg happens and the PMT or whatever gets shuffled around, all the nodes are going to follow the new canonical chain and then are going to have the same private state by consequence. This is one thing that we are working right now. And this is one of the key functionalities to make it make this usable in Ethereum mainnet, for example, because Ethereum mainnet uses a proof of work consensus algorithm. So when we are done with this piece, you can have your node on mainnet and have, you know, your privacy groups and private transactions also happening on mainnet, but not the data won't be on mainnet, but it's going to be pinged to mainnet history, right? Oh yeah, the other thing, the second point here is the privacy group consensus. And by that, I mean, making sure that the private groups are the privacy groups are consistent. I think we discussed a lot of that on the previous slide. The third thing that we are working on is the privacy group management. So at the moment, when you create a privacy group, for example, between A and B, and then I decide to bring C on board, what happens is that actually I'm going to create a new privacy group with A, B, and C. And that privacy group won't bring all the history that A and B had. There are some use cases where you might want to actually bring someone on board and let that someone access the history of that group. So the group becomes, the privacy group becomes the source of truth, and then you can add participants to that group. So this is something, one thing that we are working on at the moment. How is that possible? How is that gonna happen? And you know, how, when you add someone, how can we make sure that this someone's gonna be brought up to the, you know, state of the private group and, you know, things like that. So it's an interesting thing to be working on. And also in the roadmap, but a bit more far in the roadmap because this is still quite loose in the EA spec, are unrestricted private transactions. So, you know, again, when we talk about unrestricted private transactions, we stop talking about having these side channels or things like that. And then pretty much things happen in the public eye, and but they still don't know what exactly happened, which is an interesting thing to think about. Next slide, please, Daniel. Okay, so this is just a list of some resources that I think are going to be helpful for complement the talk. We didn't get a lot into the details of how exactly things are implemented or, you know, the constraints and things around it. So I've just added a couple of examples here, and hopefully if you guys have any questions that I'm not able to answer, or if I don't have a comprehensive answer for, you guys can check the docs and, you know, let us know. And I think that's it for the presentation. I don't know if anyone has any more questions or anything. I don't know how much time we have left.
Yeah, we are over time already, but
if
there's no other conflict, we can take a few more questions. And if people can stay. One question I had is, with these private transactions, do you have the ability for multiple nodes to actually verify that the state change was actually legitimate? I don't know if you're familiar with Fabric and endorsements, that is, you know, multiple nodes are actually executing the smart contracts and verifying the transactions. Do you have the equivalent of that?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with how Fabric does it.
Okay.
But that probably touches back on what I was talking about, how we want to make sure that the participants of a privacy group have a consistent private state.
Yeah.
Right. So at the moment, we don't have the specific functionality to verify it. But we, because the PMT are going to be, we're pinning back everything to the PMT back in the chain, and it's using the Ethereum protocol. We can say that we expect them to yield the expected private state.
So if and then let's say A and B have a private group, and A posts a transaction which affects that common state between A and mm-hmm. B, does B get to weigh in and check that that transaction is actually valid?
Yeah, that happens. So, Deno, would you mind going back to the second diagram slide, the one with the transaction processing? Yep, this one. So basically, what's going to happen is that when A and when B process the block that contains this BMT, right? Uh-huh. The private transaction processor here, it's going to apply all the transaction validation rules. So this is where we're going to check that things are consistent and that it's going to affect the state. So every participant, it's going to execute that private transaction.
So when is B going to get that? Before, after the block is finalized or before?
Yeah, so after the block is finalized.
Okay.
So the block is finalized, someone's going to mine the PMT. Because remember, the PMT is a public transaction, so it's going to go through the regular Ethereum processing, right?
Yeah.
So eventually that transaction is going to be mined, included in a block, and then the block is going to be selected to be the next block in the chain.
Yeah.
When that happens, all nodes in the network receive that block,
yeah,
including A and B.
Okay.
And that's when we get into this diagram here. So the incoming PMT arrow here basically means my node received a block that has a PMT, and I'm processing that PMT.
Okay. So now if I'm B and then I do the execution and I don't get the same result, what happens?
Oh, at the moment, if you don't get the same result, we are going to end up in an inconsistent private state.
Yeah.
And that's why we want to bring this to that it's going to, like, we want to make sure that we can verify that this happened and eventually recover from it. Or if we can recover, at least highlight that, okay, this happened, we need to do something about it.
I see. Okay.
Right?
Right.
But this is unlikely to happen, assuming that no one is tampering with the private transaction that has been propagated in Orion. It's unlikely that they're going to end up in a different private state. But again, it's not because it's unlikely.
Just,
unlikely that we don't want to check it.
Right. So I guess, you know, goes back to, are you assuming that, you know, all the nodes are well-behaved, or do you also support Byzantine nodes, right? So Byzantine nodes will do some, will have arbitrary faults and
exactly, you
know, potentially malicious actors and so forth, right? So yeah. Sounds like that portion is not Byzantine fault tolerant right now.
Exactly, yeah.
Got it. Okay, thanks. Any other questions?
Yeah, I would just ask if you guys, I guess you haven't, but I was going to ask about comparing to channels. It might be worth looking at just to see what the Fabric people did there, because it looks like they designed a very similar system.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the work that they did, but yeah, definitely I'll make a note to take a look and see how it was implemented.
All right, if anybody, last call for questions. If not, I'm going to stop the recording here.
If anyone has any other questions later on, feel free to reach us on Rocket Chat or the wiki or any other, you know, we have the email groups. It's easy to find us.